time. She found that absence, as well as pity, had also weakened her disgust of Mr. Collins. The journey would, moreover, give her a peep at Jane, and in short, as the time drew near, she would have been very sorry for any delay. Everything, however, went on smoothly, and was finally settled. She was to accompany Sir William and his second daughter. The improvement of spending a night in London was added in time, and the plan became perfect as a plan could be. The farewell between herself and Mr. Wickham was perfectly friendly, on his side even more. His present pursuit could not make him forget that Elizabeth had been the first to excite and to deserve his attention, the first to listen and to pity, the first to be admired. Her fellow travellers the next day were not of a kind to make her think him less agreeable. Sir William Lucas and his daughter Maria, a good-humoured girl, but as empty-headed and untrained as himself, had nothing to say that could be worth hearing, and were listened to with about as much delight as the rattle of the chaise. It was a journey of only 24 miles, and they began it so early as to be in Section 6 East by noon. The coachman, as was the custom on trips to town, had employed 2 young men from Meryton to ride beside him with muskets. This was done in spite of the fact that Elizabeth was herself fully armed, and more than capable of defending them should they encounter any unpleasantness. When they were but 3 miles from London, and Sir William was prattling on about the particulars of his knighthood for the second time in as many hours, the chaise lurched to a halt. The suddenness of this was enough to send Maria flying from one side of the carriage to the other, and was promptly followed by frightened shouts and the crack of powder outside. Had Elizabeth not been graced with steady nerves and the fortitude of years of combat, she might have gasped upon pulling back one of the curtains, for there were no less than 100 unmentionables surrounding them on all sides. One of the young musketmen had been dragged off the chaise and was being devoured, while the other 2 living men fired clumsily into the crowd as the hands of the dead pulled at their pant legs. Elizabeth grabbed her Brown Bess and katana sword and told Sir William and Maria to remain as they were. She kicked open the door and sprang atop the coach. From here, Elizabeth could appreciate the full measure of their predicament, for rather than 100 unmentionables, she now perceived no less than twice that number. The coachman's leg was in the possession of several zombies who were quite close to getting their teeth on his ankle. Seeing no alternative, Elizabeth brought her sword down upon his thigh, amputating the leg, but saving the man. She picked him up with one arm and lowered him into the coach, where he fainted as blood poured forth from his new stump. Sadly, this action prevented her from saving the second musket man, who had been pulled from his perch. He screamed as the dreadfuls held him down and began to tear organs from his living belly and feast upon them. The zombies next turned their attention to the terrified horses. Elizabeth knew that she and the present party were all doomed to slow deaths if the horses should fall into Satan's hands, so she sprang skyward, firing her musket as she flew through the air, her bullets penetrating the heads of several unmentionables. She landed on her feet beside one of the horses, and with her sword began cutting down the attackers with all the grace of Aphrodite and all the ruthlessness of Herod. Her feet, fists, and blade were too swift for the clumsy horde, and they began to retreat. Seeing her chance, Elizabeth sheathed her katana, sprang into the driver's box, and grabbed the reins. The zombies had already begun to regroup as she cracked the coachman's whip, driving the horses forward and carrying them down the road at a rather unsafe speed, until she was satisfied that the danger had passed. Shortly thereafter, they approached the southern face of London's wall. Though she had once walked upon China's Great Wall, Elizabeth was nonetheless impressed whenever she had occasion to lay eyes upon Britain's barrier. Considered alone, each section offered little to boast of. The wall was similar in height and appearance to that of many older castles, and punctuated by the occasional gorge tower or cannon port. But considered as a whole, the wall was so massive as to defy the notions of what was possible with human hands. Elizabeth brought the carriage to a halt at the southern guard tower. 12 or more chaises were stopped ahead of them, waiting as the guards searched for contraband and made certain that none of the passengers showed signs of the strange plague. Sir William poked his head out and informed Elizabeth that the coachman had died, and asked if she thought it appropriate to leave his body beside the road. As they drove to Mr. Gardiner's door, Jane was at the drawing-room window watching their arrival. When they entered the passage, she was there to welcome them, surprised by the sight of Elizabeth in the driver's box. Elizabeth's spirits lifted at the sight of her sister, who looked as healthful and lovely as ever. She relayed the details of their unhappy journey as swiftly as she could, and begged they speak no more of it, except to say that she had never seen such a number of unmentionables together in the country, and wonder why so many would attack a single chaise. The day passed most pleasantly away, the morning in bustle and shopping, and the evening at one of the theatres. Elizabeth then contrived to sit by her aunt. Their first object was her sister, and she was more grieved than astonished to hear, in reply to her minute inquiries, that though Jane always struggled to support her spirits, there were periods of dejection. It was reasonable, however, to hope that they would not continue long. Mrs. Gardiner gave her the particulars also of Miss Bingley's visit in Section 6 East, and repeated conversations occurring at different times between Jane and herself, which proved that the former had, from her heart, given up the acquaintance. Mrs. Gardiner then rallied her niece on Wickham's desertion, and complimented her on bearing it so well. "But my dear Elizabeth," she added, "what sort of girl is this new object of his affections? I should be sorry to think our friend mercenary." "Pray, my dear aunt, what is the difference in matrimonial affairs between the mercenary and the prudent motive? Last Christmas you were afraid of his marrying me because it would be imprudent, and now, because he is trying to get a girl with only £10,000, you think him mercenary. If you will only tell me what sort of girl she is, I shall know what to think. She is a very good kind of girl, I believe. I know no harm of her." Before they were separated by the conclusion of the play, Elizabeth had the unexpected happiness of an invitation to accompany her uncle and aunt in a tour of pleasure which they proposed taking in the summer. "We have not determined how far it shall carry us," said Mrs. Gardiner, "but perhaps to the lakes." No scheme could have been more agreeable to Elizabeth, and her acceptance of the invitation was most ready and grateful. "My dear, dear aunt," she rapturously cried, "what delight, what felicity! You give me fresh life and vigour. Adieu to disappointment and spleen. What are young men to rocks and mountains? Oh, what hours of mountain-top sparring shall we spend! How many bucks we shall fell with nothing more than our daggers and swiftness of foot! Oh, how we will please Buddha by communing with the earth!" Chapter 28. Every object in the next day's journey was new and interesting to Elizabeth. With a new coachman and twice their original number of musket men, they hastened to Hunsford. Once arrived, their journey happily uneventful, every eye was in search of the parsonage, and every turning expected to bring it in view. Rosings Park was their boundary on one side. Elizabeth smiled at the recollection of all that she had heard of its inhabitants. At length the parsonage was discernible. The garden sloping to the road, the house standing in it, the green pales and the laurel hedge, everything declared they were arriving. Elizabeth felt at once relaxed, for there had been no reports of zombies in Hunsford for years. Many attributed this to the presence of Lady Catherine, so great a slayer that the stricken dared not venture too close to her home. Mr. Collins and Charlotte appeared at the door, and the carriage stopped at the small gate, which led by a short gravel walk to the house, amidst the nods and smiles of the whole party. In a moment they were all out of the chaise, rejoicing at the sight of each other. But when Mrs. Collins welcomed Elizabeth, the latter was greatly distressed by the appearance of the former. It had been months since she had seen Charlotte, and kind months they had not been, for her friend's skin was now quite grey and marked with sores, and her speech appallingly laboured. That none of the others noticed this, Elizabeth attributed to their stupidity, particularly Mr. Collins, who apparently had no idea that his wife was three-quarters dead. They were taken into the house, and as soon as they were in the parlour, Mr. Collins welcomed them a second time with ostentatious formality to his humble abode, and punctually repeated all his wife's offers of refreshment. Elizabeth was prepared to see him in his glory, and she could not help in fancying that in displaying the good proportion of the room, its aspect, and its furniture, he addressed himself particularly to her, as if wishing to make her feel what she had lost in refusing him. But though everything seemed neat and comfortable, she was not able to gratify him by any sigh of repentance. After sitting long enough to admire every article of furniture in the room, Mr. Collins invited them to take a stroll in the garden. To work in this garden was one of his most respectable pleasures, and Elizabeth admired Charlotte's efforts to talk of the healthfulness of the exercise, even though it was quite difficult to understand her. From his garden, Mr. Collins would have led them round his two meadows, but the ladies, not having shoes to encounter the remains of a white frost, turned back, and while Sir William accompanied him, Charlotte took her sister and friend over the house. It was rather small, but well-built and convenient. Though she was pleased to see her friend comfortably settled, there was a grief about the whole affair, for Charlotte would not long be able to enjoy her happiness. She had already learnt that Lady Catherine was still in the country. It was spoken of again while they were at dinner, when Mr. Collins, joining in, observed, "Yes, Miss Elizabeth, you will have the honour of seeing Lady Catherine de Bourgh on the ensuing Sunday at church, and I need not say you will be delighted with her. Her behaviour to my dear Charlotte is charming. We dine at Rosings twice every week, and are never allowed to walk home. Her ladyship's carriage is regularly ordered for us. I should say one of her ladyship's carriages, for she has several."
"Lady Catherine, very respectable, sensible woman,"
groaned Charlotte.
"And most attentive neighbour."
"Very true, my dear, that is exactly what I say. She is the sort of woman whom one cannot regard with too much deference." As dinner continued in this manner, Elizabeth's eye was continually drawn to Charlotte, who hovered over her plate, using a spoon to shovel goose meat and gravy in the general direction of her mouth, with limited success. As she did, one of the sores beneath her eye burst, sending a trickle of bloody pus down her cheek and into her mouth. Apparently she found the added flavour agreeable, for it only increased the frequency of her spoonfuls. Elizabeth, however, could not help but vomit ever so slightly into her handkerchief. The rest of the evening was spent chiefly in talking over Hertfordshire news and telling again what had already been written, and when it closed, Elizabeth, in the solitude of her chamber, had to meditate upon Charlotte's worsening condition, and how no one, even Lady Catherine, supposed to be the greatest of all zombie slayers, had noticed it. About the middle of the next day, as she was in her room getting ready for a walk, a sudden noise below seemed to speak the whole house in confusion, and after listening a moment she heard somebody running upstairs in a violent hurry and calling loudly after her. Elizabeth grabbed her katana, opened the door, and met Maria in the landing place, who cried out,
"Oh, my dear Eliza, pray make haste and come into the dining room, for there is such a sight to be seen. I will not tell you what it is. Make haste and come down this moment."
Maria would tell her nothing more, and down they ran into the dining room, which fronted the lane, in quest of this wonder. It was merely two ladies stopping in a low carriage at the garden gate. "And is this all?" cried Elizabeth. "I expected at least a dozen unmentionables, and here is nothing but Lady Catherine and her daughter."
"La, my dear," said Maria, quite shocked at the mistake, "it is not Lady Catherine. The old lady is Mrs. Jenkinson, who lives with them. The other is Miss de Bourgh. Only look at her. She is quite a little creature. Who would have thought she could be so thin and small? She is abominably rude to keep Charlotte out of doors in all this wind. Why does she not come in?" "Oh, Charlotte says she hardly ever does. It is the greatest of favours when Miss de Bourgh comes in." "I like her appearance," said Elizabeth, struck with other ideas. "She looks sickly and cross. Yes, she will do for Mr. Darcy very well. She will make him a very proper wife."
Mr. Collins and Charlotte were both standing at the gate in conversation with the ladies, and Sir William, to Elizabeth's high diversion, was stationed in the doorway in earnest contemplation of the greatness before him, and constantly bowing whenever Miss de Bourgh looked that way. At length there was nothing more to be said. The ladies drove on, and the others returned into the house. Mr. Collins no sooner saw the two girls than he began to congratulate them on their good fortune, for he informed them that the whole party was asked to dine at Rosings the next day. Apparently overcome with excitement, Charlotte dropped to the ground and began stuffing handfuls of crisp autumn leaves in her mouth. Chapter 29
I confess, said Mr. Collins, that I should not have been at all surprised by her ladyship's asking us on Sunday to drink tea and spend the evening at Rosings. I rather expected, from my knowledge of her affability, that it would happen. But who could have foreseen such an attention as this? Who could have imagined that we should receive an invitation to dine there so immediately after your arrival?
I am the less surprised at what has happened, replied Sir William, for her superior mastery of the deadly arts and high breeding are known throughout the courts of Europe.
Scarcely anything was talked of the whole day or next morning but their visit to Rosings. Mr. Collins was carefully instructing them in what they were to expect, that the sight of such rooms, so many servants, a personal guard of 25 ninjas, and so splendid a dinner might not wholly overpower them. When the ladies were separating for their toilette, he said to Elizabeth,
"Do not make yourself uneasy, my dear cousin, about your apparel. Lady Catherine is far from requiring that elegance of dress in us which becomes herself and her daughter. I would advise you merely to put on whatever of your clothes is superior to the rest. There is no occasion for anything more. Lady Catherine will not think the worse of you for being simply dressed, just as she will not think less of you for possessing combat skills so very beneath her own."
Elizabeth's fists clenched at the insult, but out of affection for her three-quarters dead friend, she held her tongue and sword. While they were dressing, he came two or three times to their different doors to recommend their being quick, as Lady Catherine very much objected to being kept waiting for her dinner. As the weather was fine, they had a pleasant walk of about half a mile across the park. When they ascended the steps to the hall, Maria's alarm was every moment increasing, and even Sir William did not look perfectly calm. Elizabeth's courage did not fail her, even though she had been regaled with stories of Lady Catherine's accomplishments from the time she had been old enough to hold her first dagger. The mere stateliness of money or rank she could witness without trepidation, but the presence of a woman who had slain 90 dreadfuls with nothing more than a rain-soaked envelope was an intimidating prospect indeed. They followed the servants through an antechamber to the room where Lady Catherine, her daughter, and Mrs. Jenkinson were sitting. Her ladyship, with great condescension, arose to receive them, and as Mrs. Collins had settled it with her husband that the office of introduction should be hers, it was performed with no shortage of difficulty as she struggled to speak in a manner comprehensible to others. In spite of having been at St. James's, Sir William was so completely awed by the grandeur surrounding him that he had but just courage enough to make a very low bow and take his seat without saying a word, and his daughter, frightened almost out of her senses, sat on the edge of her chair, not knowing which way to look. Elizabeth found herself quite equal to the scene, and could observe the three ladies before her composedly. Lady Catherine was a tall, large woman with strongly marked features which might once have been handsome. Her once flawless figure had been softened by age, but her eyes were no less striking than Elizabeth had oft heard them described. They were the eyes of a woman who once held the wrath of God in her hands. Elizabeth wondered how much quickness those famed hands still possessed. When, after examining the mother, in whose countenance and deportment she soon found some resemblance of Mr. Darcy, she turned her eyes on the daughter. She could almost have joined in Maria's astonishment at her being so thin and so small. There was neither in figure nor face any likeness between the ladies. Mr. Berg was pale and sickly, Her features, though not plain, were insignificant, and she spoke very little, except in a low voice, to Mrs. Jenkinson, in whose appearance there was nothing remarkable, and who was entirely engaged in listening to what she said. After sitting a few minutes, they were all sent to one of the windows to admire the view, Mr. Collins attending them to point out its beauties, and Lady Catherine kindly informing them that it was much better worth looking at in the summer. The dinner was exceedingly handsome, and there were all the servants and all the articles of plate which Mr. Collins had promised, and, as he had likewise foretold, he took his seat at the bottom of the table, by her ladyship's desire, and looked as if he felt that life could furnish nothing greater. The party did not supply much conversation. Elizabeth was ready to speak whenever there was an opening, but she was seated between Charlotte and Miss de Bourgh, the former of whom had to be frequently reminded to use her silver, and the latter said not a word to her all dinner-time. When the ladies returned to the drawing-room, there was little to be done but to hear Lady Catherine talk of her attempts to create a serum which would slow, or even reverse, the effects of the strange plague. Elizabeth was surprised to learn that her ladyship was thus engaged, for trifling in plague cures was considered the last refuge of the naive. The greatest minds in England had been vexed by the same pursuit for 25 years. She inquired into Charlotte's domestic concerns familiarly and minutely, and gave her a great deal of advice as to the management of them all, and told her how everything ought to be regulated in so small a family as hers. Elizabeth found that nothing was beneath this great lady's attention which could furnish her with an occasion of dictating to others. In the intervals of her discourse with Mrs. Collins, she addressed a variety of questions to Maria and Elizabeth, but especially to the latter, of whose connections she knew the least. "Mr. Collins tells me you are schooled in the deadly arts, Miss Bennet."
"I am, though not to half the level of proficiency your ladyship has attained."
"Oh, then some time or other I shall be happy to see you spar with one of my ninjas." "Are your sisters likewise trained?"
"They are."
"I assume you were schooled in Japan?"
"No, your ladyship, in China."
"China? Are those monks still selling their clumsy kung fu to the English? I take it you mean Shaolin?"
"Yes, your ladyship, under Master Liu."
"Well, I suppose you had no opportunity. Had your father more means, he should have taken you to Kyoto."
"My mother would have had no objection, but my father hates Japan."
"Have your ninjas left you?"
"We never had any ninjas."
"No ninjas? How was that possible? 5 daughters brought up at home without any ninjas? I never heard of such a thing. Your mother must have been quite a slave to your safety."
Elizabeth could hardly help smiling as she assured her that had not been the case.
"Then who protected you when you saw your first combat? Without ninjas, you must have been quite a sorry spectacle indeed."
"Compared with some families, I believe we were, but such was our desire to prevail, and our affection for each other, that we had no trouble vanquishing even our earliest opponents."
"If I had known your mother, I should have advised her most strenuously to engage a team of ninjas. I always say that nothing is to be done in education without steady and regular instruction. Had my own daughter been blessed with a more suitable constitution, I should have sent her away to the best dojos in Japan at the age of 4. Are any of your younger sisters out, Miss Bennet?"
"Yes, ma'am, all."
"All? What, all 5 out at once? Very odd. And you only the second. The younger ones out before the elder ones are married. Your younger sisters must be very young."
"Yes, my youngest is not 16. Perhaps she is full young to be much in company. But really, ma'am, I think it would be very hard upon younger sisters that they should not have their share of society and amusement, because the elder may not have the means or inclination to marry early. The last born has as good a right to the pleasures of youth as the first, and to be kept back on such a motive.
I think it would not be very likely to promote sisterly affection or delicacy of mind.
Upon my word, said her ladyship, you give your opinion very decidedly for so young a person. Pray, what is your age?
With three younger sisters grown up, replied Elizabeth, smiling, your ladyship can hardly expect me to own it. Lady Catherine seemed quite astonished at not receiving a direct answer, and Elizabeth suspected herself to be the first creature who had ever dared to trifle with so much dignified impertinence.
"You cannot be more than 20, I am sure. Therefore you need not conceal your age."
"I am not 21. When the gentlemen had joined them and tea was over, the card tables were placed. Lady Catherine, Sir William, and Mr. and Mrs. Collins sat down to Crypt and Coffin, and as Mr. Berg chose to play Whip the Vicar, Elizabeth and Maria had the honour of assisting Mrs. Jenkinson to make up her party. Their table was superlatively stupid. Scarcely a syllable was uttered that did not relate to the game, except when Mrs. Jenkinson expressed her fears of Mr. Berg's being too hot or too cold, or having too much or too little light. A great deal more passed at the other table. Lady Catherine was generally speaking, stating the mistakes of the three others, or relating some anecdote of herself. Mr. Collins was employed in agreeing to everything her ladyship said, thanking her for every empty crypt he won, and apologizing if he thought he won too many. After drooling a third cup of tea onto her lap, Charlotte stood to excuse herself from the other table, clutching her stomach and wearing a rather pained expression.
"I beg your pardon, your ladyship."
Lady Catherine gave no acknowledgement, and Mr. Collins and Sir William were too engrossed in their game to notice what happened next. Elizabeth watched Charlotte bow slightly, and then limped to the furthest corner of the room, where she lifted the bottom of her gown and bent her knees into a squat. Elizabeth immediately excused herself, rose, and, taking care not to draw attention, grabbed Charlotte by the arm and escorted her to the toilette, where she watched her stricken friend suffer through a quarter hour of a sickness so severe that decorum prevents its description in these pages. The tables were shortly after broken up. The carriage was offered to Mrs. Collins, gratefully accepted, and immediately ordered. The party then gathered round the fire to hear Lady Catherine determine what weather they were to have on the morrow. From these instructions they were summoned by the arrival of the coach, and with many speeches of thankfulness on Mr. Collins's side, and as many bows on Sir William's, they departed. As soon as they had driven from the door, Elizabeth was called on by her cousin to give her opinion of all that she had seen at Rosings, which, for Charlotte's sake, she made more favourable than it really was. Lady Catherine the Great had been a disappointment in every sense, and Elizabeth could not forgive the slight against her temple and master. Chapter 30 Sir William stayed only a week at Hunsford, but his visit was long enough to convince him of his daughter's being most comfortably settled. Mr. Collins devoted his mornings to driving Sir William out in his gig and showing him the country, but when he went away, the whole family returned to their usual employments. Now and then they were honoured with a call from Lady Catherine, and nothing escaped her observation during these visits. She examined into their employments, looked at their work, and advised them to do it differently, found fault with the arrangement of the furniture, or detected the housemaid in negligence, and if she accepted any refreshment, seemed to do it only for the sake of finding out that Mrs. Collins's joints of meat were too large for her family. Elizabeth soon perceived that though this great lady was no longer engaged in the daily defence of her country, she was a most active magistrate in her own parish, the minutest concerns of which were carried to her by Mr. Collins, and whenever any of the cottagers were disposed to be quarrelsome, discontented, or too poor, she sallied forth into the village to implore them to settle their differences, or failing that, wielding her still mighty blade to settle them herself. The entertainment of dining at Rosings was repeated about twice a week, and allowing for the loss of Sir William and there being only one card table in the evening, every such entertainment was the counterpart of the first. On one such occasion, Elizabeth was solicited to spar with several of her ladyship's ninjas for the amusement of the party. The demonstration took place in Lady Catherine's grand dojo, which she had paid to have carried from Kyoto, brick by brick, on the backs of peasants. The ninjas wore their traditional black clothing, masks, and tabi boots. Elizabeth wore her sparring gown and her trusted katana sword. As Lady Catherine rose to signal the beginning of the match, Elizabeth, in a show of defiance, blindfolded herself. "My dear girl," said her ladyship, "I suggest you take this contest seriously. My ninjas will show you no mercy."
"Nor I they, your ladyship."
"Miss Bennet, I remind you that you lack proper instruction in the deadly arts. Your master was a Chinese monk. These ninjas hail from the finest dojos in Japan."
"If my fighting is truly inferior, then your ladyship shall be spared the trouble of watching it for very long."
Elizabeth set her feet, and Lady Catherine, realizing she would never convince such a stubborn, unusual girl, snapped her fingers. The first ninja drew his sword and let out a battle cry as he charged directly at Elizabeth. When his blade was only inches from her throat, she moved from her opponent's path and dragged her katana across his belly. The ninja dropped to the floor, his innards spilling from the slit faster than he could stuff them back in. Elizabeth sheathed her sword, knelt behind him, and strangled him to death with his own large bowel. Lady Catherine snapped her fingers a second time, and another ninja charged, this one unleashing throwing stars as he advanced. Elizabeth drew her katana and shielded herself from the first three flying weapons, then snatched the fourth out of the air and threw it back at its originator, striking him in the thigh. The ninja cried out and grabbed the wound with both hands, and Elizabeth brought her blade down, taking off not only the hands but the leg, which they held firmly. The ninja fell to the floor and was promptly beheaded. Though discontented with such a beginning, Lady Catherine held the greatest hopes for her third and final ninja, the deadliest of the three. But no sooner had she snapped her fingers than Elizabeth flung her katana across the dojo, piercing the ninja's chest and pinning him against a wooden column. Elizabeth removed her blindfold and confronted her opponent, who presently clutched the sword handle, gasping for breath. She delivered a vicious blow, penetrating his ribcage, and withdrew her hand, with the ninja's still beating heart in it. As all but Lady Catherine turned away in disgust, Elizabeth took a bite, letting the blood run down her chin and onto her sparring gown.
"Curious," said Elizabeth, still chewing. "I have tasted many a heart, but I dare say I find the Japanese ones a bit tender."
Her ladyship left the dojo without giving compliment to Elizabeth's skills. Their other engagements were few, as the style of living in the neighbourhood was beyond Mr. Collins's reach. This, however, was no evil to Elizabeth, and upon the whole she spent her time comfortably enough. There were half-hours of pained, almost unintelligible conversation with Charlotte, and the weather was so fine for the time of year that she had often great enjoyment out of doors. Her favourite walk was along the open grove which edged that side of the park, where there was a nice sheltered path which no one seemed to value but herself, and where she felt beyond the reach of Lady Catherine's curiosity. In this quiet way, the first fortnight of her visit soon passed away. Easter was approaching, and the week preceding it was to bring an addition to the family at Rosings, which in so small a circle must be important. Elizabeth had heard soon after her arrival that Mr. Darcy was expected there in the course of a few weeks, and though there were not many of her acquaintances whom she did not prefer, his coming would furnish one comparatively new to look at in the Rosings parties, and she might be amused in seeing how hopeless Miss Bingley's designs on him were by his behaviour to his cousin, for whom he was evidently destined by Lady Catherine, who talked of his coming with the greatest satisfaction, spoke of him in terms of the highest admiration, and seemed almost angry to find that he had already been frequently seen by Miss Lucas and herself. His arrival was soon known at the parsonage, for Mr. Collins was walking the whole morning within view of the lodges opening into Hunsford Lane in order to have the earliest assurance of it, and after making his bow as the carriage turned into the park, hurried home with the great intelligence. On the following morning he hastened to Rosings to pay his respects. There were two nephews of Lady Catherine to require them, for Mr. Darcy had brought with him a Colonel Fitzwilliam, the younger son of his uncle, and, to the great surprise of all the party, when Mr. Collins returned, the gentleman accompanied him. Charlotte had seen them from her husband's room, crossing the road, and immediately running into the other, told the girls what an honour they might expect, adding,
"I thank you, Eliza, for this piece of servility. Mr. Darcy would never have come so soon to wait upon me."
Elizabeth had scarcely time to disclaim all right to the compliment before their approach was announced by the doorbell, and shortly afterwards the three gentlemen entered the room. Colonel Fitzwilliam, who led the way, was about 30, not handsome, but in person and address most truly the gentleman. Mr. Darcy looked just as he had been used to look in Hertfordshire, paid his compliments with his usual reserve to Mrs. Collins, and whatever might be his feelings toward her friend, met her with every appearance of composure. Elizabeth merely curtsied to him without saying a word. Colonel Fitzwilliam entered into conversation directly with the readiness and ease of a well-bred man, and talked very pleasantly. But his cousin, after having addressed a slight observation on the house and garden to Mrs. Collins, sat for some time without speaking to anybody. At length, however, his civility was so far awakened as to inquire of Elizabeth after the health of her family. She answered him in the usual way, and after a moment's pause, added, "My eldest sister has been in town these 3 months. Have you never happened to see her there?" She was perfectly sensible that he never had, but she wished to see whether he would betray any consciousness of what had passed between the Bingleys and Jane, and she thought she perceived a slight twitch in his eye as he answered that he had never been so fortunate as to meet Miss Bennet. The subject was pursued no farther, and the gentleman soon afterwards went away. Chapter 31 Colonel Fitzwilliam's manners were very much admired at the parsonage, and the ladies all felt that he must add considerably to the pleasures of their engagements at Rosings. It was some days, however, before they received any invitation thither, for while there were visitors in the house they could not be necessary, and it was not till Easter Day, almost a week after the Colonel's arrival, that they were honoured by such an attention, and then they were merely asked on leaving church to come there in the evening. The invitation was accepted, of course, and at a proper hour they joined the party in Lady Catherine's drawing-room. Her ladyship received them civilly, but it was plain that their company was by no means so acceptable as when she could get nobody else. Colonel Fitzwilliam seemed really glad to see them. Anything was a welcome relief to him at Rosings, and Mrs. Collins' pretty friend had moreover caught his fancy very much. He now seated himself by her, and talked so agreeably of the engagements at Manchester, of the marvel of new mechanical weapons, of his favourite methods of slaying the sorry stricken, that Elizabeth had never been half so well entertained in that room before, and they conversed with so much spirit and flow as to draw the attention of Lady Catherine herself, as well as of Mr. Darcy. His eyes had been repeatedly turned towards them with a look of curiosity, and that her ladyship, after a while, shared the feeling was more openly acknowledged, for she did not scruple to call out, "What is that you are saying, Fitzwilliam? What is it you are talking of? What are you telling Miss Bennet? Let me hear what it is." "We are speaking of the deadly arts, madam," said he, when no longer able to avoid a reply. "Of the deadly arts? Then pray speak aloud. It is of all subjects my delight. I must have my share in the conversation if you are speaking of the deadly arts. There are few people in England, I suppose, who have more true enjoyment of them than myself, or a better natural ability. Had Anne's health allowed her to apply, I am confident that she would have become as great a slayer of zombies as I."
"How does Georgiana get on with her training, Darcy?"
Mr. Darcy spoke with affectionate praise of his sister's proficiency with blade, fist, and Brown Bess.
"I am very glad to hear such a good account of her," said Lady Catherine. "And pray tell her from me that she cannot expect to excel if she does not practice a good deal."
"I assure you, madam," he replied, "that she does not need such advice. She practices very constantly."
"So much the better. It cannot be done too much, and when I next write to her, I shall charge her not to neglect it on any account. I often tell young ladies that no excellence in the deadly arts is to be acquired without constant practice. I have told Miss Bennet several times that she will never be half my equal unless she practices more, and though Mrs. Collins has no dojo, she is very welcome, as I have often told her, to come to Rosings every day and spar with my ninjas, provided she promises to kill no more of them. She would be in nobody's way, you know, in that part of the house."
Mr. Darcy looked a little ashamed of his aunt's ill-breeding and made no answer. When coffee was over, Colonel Fitzwilliam reminded Elizabeth of having promised to give them a demonstration of her considerable finger strength, and she set about fastening a modesty string around her ankles. Lady Catherine and the others observed as Elizabeth placed her hands upon the floor and lifted her feet heavenward, her dress kept in place by the modesty string. Holding herself thus, she then lifted one of her palms off the floor so that all of her weight rested on but one hand. Mr. Darcy presently stationed himself so as to command a full view of the fair performer's countenance. Elizabeth saw what he was doing, and at the first convenient pause wore an arch smile and said, "You mean to frighten me, Mr. Darcy, by coming in all this state to see me? I will not be alarmed. There is a stubbornness about me that can never bear to be frightened at the will of others. My courage always rises at every attempt to intimidate me." To emphasize this point, she lifted her palm so that only one fingertip remained connected to the floor.
"I shall not say you are mistaken," he replied, "because you could not really believe me to entertain any design of alarming you, and I have had the pleasure of your acquaintance long enough to know that you find great enjoyment in occasionally professing opinions which in fact are not your own."
Elizabeth laughed heartily at this picture of herself, and said to Colonel Fitzwilliam, "Your cousin will give you a very pretty notion of me, and teach you not to believe a word I say. I am particularly unlucky in meeting with a person so able to expose my real character in a part of the world where I had hoped to pass myself off with some degree of credit. Indeed, Mr. Darcy, it is very ungenerous in you to mention all that you knew to my disadvantage in Hertfordshire, for it is provoking me to retaliate. And such things may come out as will shock your relations to hear."
"I am not afraid of you," said he, smilingly.
"Pray, let me hear what you have to accuse him of," cried Colonel Fitzwilliam. "I should like to know how he behaves among strangers."
"You shall hear, then, but prepare yourself for something very dreadful."
Elizabeth pushed off the floor with her fingertip, landed gently on her feet, and unfastened her modesty string. "The first time of my ever seeing him in Hertfordshire, you must know, was at a ball, and at this ball, what do you think he did? He danced only four dances, though gentlemen were scarce, and to my certain knowledge more than one young lady was sitting down in want of a partner. Mr. Darcy, you cannot deny the fact."
"I had not at that time the honour of knowing any lady in the assembly beyond my own party."
"True,
and nobody can ever be introduced in a ballroom.
Well, Colonel Fitzwilliam, what shall I demonstrate next? My fingers wait your orders."
"Perhaps," said Darcy, "I should have judged better had I sought an introduction, but I am ill qualified to recommend myself to strangers."
"Shall we ask your cousin the reason of this?"
said Elizabeth, still addressing Colonel Fitzwilliam.
"Shall we ask him why a man of sense and education, and who has been sculpted into a killer of the highest order, is ill-qualified to recommend himself to strangers?"
"I can answer your question," said Fitzwilliam, "without applying to him. It is because he will not give himself the trouble."
"I certainly have not the talent which some people possess," said Darcy, "of conversing easily with those I have never seen before.
I cannot catch their tone of conversation or appear interested in their concerns, as I often see done.
My fingers, said Elizabeth, do not possess the strength your aunt's do. They have not the same force or rapidity, and do not produce the same deadly results. But then I have always supposed it to be my own fault, because I will not take the trouble of practicing. It is not that I do not believe my fingers as capable.
Darcy smiled and said, You are perfectly right. You have employed your time much better. Here they were interrupted by Lady Catherine, who called out to know what they were talking of. Elizabeth immediately fastened her modesty string and began walking about the room on her fingertips. Lady Catherine, after observing for a few minutes, said to Darcy, Miss Bennet would make a fine showing of leopard's claw if she practiced more and could have the advantage of a Japanese master. She has a very good notion of fingering.
That she does, said Darcy, in a manner such as to make Elizabeth's face quite red.
Elizabeth looked at Darcy to see how cordially he attended to Miss de Bourgh, but neither at that moment nor at any other could she discern any symptom of love, and from the whole of his behaviour to her she derived this comfort for Miss Bingley, that he might have been just as likely to marry her had she been his relation. Lady Catherine continued her remarks on Elizabeth's performance, mixing with them many instructions on execution. Elizabeth received them with all the forbearance of civility, and at the request of the gentleman remained on her fingertips till her ladyship's carriage was ready to take them all home. Chapter 32 Elizabeth was sitting by herself the next morning, meditating, while Mr. Collins and Maria were gone on business into the village, when she was startled by a ring at the door. As she had heard no carriage, she thought it not unlikely to be Lady Catherine, and under that apprehension was extinguishing her incense, when the door opened, and to her very great surprise, Mr. Darcy entered the room. He seemed astonished, too, on finding her alone, and apologized for his intrusion by letting her know that he had understood all the ladies were to be within. They then sat down, and when her inquiries after Rosings were made, seemed in danger of sinking into total silence. It was absolutely necessary, therefore, to think of something, and in this emergence, recollecting when she had seen him last in Hertfordshire, and feeling curious to know what he would say on the subject of their hasty departure, she observed, "How very suddenly you all quitted Netherfield last November, Mr. Darcy. It must have been a most agreeable surprise to Mr. Bingley to see you all after him so soon, for if I recollect right, he went but the day before. He and his sisters were well, I hope, when you left London?"
"Perfectly so, I thank you." She found that she was to receive no other answer, and after a short pause added,
"I think I have understood that Mr. Bingley has not much idea of ever returning to Netherfield again."
"I have never heard him say so, but it is probable that he may spend very little of his time there in the future. He is rather afraid of zombies, and their numbers in that part of the country are continually increasing."
If he means to be but little at Netherfield, it would be better for the neighbourhood that he should give up the place entirely, for then we might possibly get a settled family there, one with a keener interest in the deadly arts.
But perhaps Mr. Bingley did not take the house so much for the convenience of the neighbourhood as for his own, and we must expect him to keep it or quit it on the same principle.
I should not be surprised, said Darcy, if he were to give it up as soon as any eligible purchase offers.
Elizabeth made no answer. She was afraid of talking longer of his friend, and, having nothing else to say, was now determined to leave the trouble of finding a subject to him. He took the hint, and soon began with, "This seems a very comfortable house. Lady Catherine, I believe, did a great deal to it when Mr. Collins first came to Hunsford."
"I believe she did, and I'm sure she could not have bestowed her kindness on a more grateful object."
"Mr. Collins appears to be very fortunate in his choice of a wife."
Elizabeth detected hesitation in his compliment. Was he sensible of Charlotte's being stricken? Yes, indeed. His friends may well rejoice in his having met with one of the very few sensible women who would have accepted him, or have made him happy if they had. My friend has an excellent understanding, though I am not certain that I consider her marrying Mr. Collins as the wisest thing she ever did. She seems perfectly happy, however, and in a prudential light it is certainly a very good match for her.
It must be very agreeable for her to be settled within so easy a distance of her own family and friends.
An easy distance, do you call it? It is nearly 50 miles.
And what is 50 miles of zombie-free road? Little more than half a day's journey. Yes, I call it a very easy distance.
I should never have considered the distance as one of the advantages of the match, cried Elizabeth. I should never have said Mrs. Collins was settled near her family.
It is a proof of your own attachment to Hertfordshire. Anything beyond the very neighbourhood of Longbourn, I suppose, would appear far.
As he spoke, he let slip a sort of smile which Elizabeth fancied she understood. He must be supposing her to be thinking of Jane and Netherfield, and she blushed as she answered,
"Sir, you forget that I have twice made the journey to the darkest reaches of the Orient, a journey you know to be frightfully long and fraught with bears. I assure you, my picture of the world is rather a bit bigger than Longbourn. However, Mr. and Mrs. Collins have never had a need of embarking on such adventures, so I suspect their ideas of distance are much like those of other ordinary people. I am likewise persuaded my friend would not call herself near her family under less than half the present distance."
Mr. Darcy drew his chair a little towards her. Elizabeth looked surprised.
The gentleman experienced some change of feeling. He drew back his chair, took a newspaper from the table, and glancing over it, said in a colder voice,
"Are you pleased with the news from Sheffield?"
A short dialogue on the subject of the army's recent victory ensued, on either side calm and concise, and soon put an end to by the entrance of Charlotte and her sister, just returned from her walk. The tête-à-tête surprised them. Mr. Darcy related the mistake which had occasioned his intruding on Miss Bennet, and after sitting a few minutes longer without saying much to anybody, went away.
"What can be the meaning of this?"
howled Charlotte as soon as he was gone.
"My dear Eliza, he must be love you. He never would have called in this familiar way."
But when Elizabeth told of his silence, it did not seem very likely, even to Charlotte's wishes, to be the case. And after various conjectures, they could at last only suppose his visit to proceed from the difficulty of finding anything to do, which was the more probable from the time of year. The ground was quite frozen, and neither fresh unmentionables nor field sports would be seen again till spring. Within doors there was Lady Catherine, books, and a billiard table, but gentlemen cannot always be within doors, and in the nearness of the parsonage, or the pleasantness of the walk to it, or of the people who lived in it, the two cousins found a temptation from this period of walking thither almost every day. They called at various times of the morning, sometimes separately, sometimes together, and now and then accompanied by their aunt. It was plain to them all that Colonel Fitzwilliam came because he had pleasure in their society, a persuasion which, of course, recommended him still more. But why Mr. Darcy came so often to the parsonage, it was more difficult to understand. It could not be for society, as he frequently sat there 10 minutes together without opening his lips, and when he did speak, it seemed the effect of necessity rather than of choice. He seldom appeared really animated, even at the sight of Mrs. Collins gnawing upon her own hand. What remained of Charlotte would like to have believed this changed the effect of love, and the object of that love, her friend Eliza. She watched him whenever they were at Rosings, and whenever he came to Hunsford, but without much success, for her thoughts often wandered to other subjects, such as the warm, succulent sensation of biting into a fresh brain. Mr. Darcy certainly looked at her friend a great deal, but the expression of that look was disputable. It was an earnest, steadfast gaze, but she often doubted whether there were much admiration in it, and sometimes it seemed nothing but absence of mind.
and upon imagining Mr. Darcy's mind, her thoughts would again turn to the subject of chewing on his salty, cauliflower-like brain. She had once or twice suggested to Elizabeth the possibility of his being partial to her, but Elizabeth always laughed at the idea, and Mrs. Collins did not think it right to press the subject, from the danger of raising expectations which might only end in disappointment. In her kind schemes for Elizabeth, she sometimes planned her marrying Colonel Fitzwilliam. He was beyond comparison the most pleasant man. He certainly admired her, and his situation in life was most eligible. But to counterbalance these advantages, Mr. Darcy had a considerably larger head, and thus more brains to feast upon. Chapter 33 More than once did Elizabeth, in her ramble within the park, unexpectedly meet Mr. Darcy. She felt all the perverseness of the mischance that should bring him where no one else was brought, and to prevent its ever happening again, took care to inform him at first that it was a favourite haunt of hers. How it could occur a second time, therefore, was very odd. Yet it did, and even a third. He never said a great deal, nor did she give herself the trouble of talking or of listening much. But it struck her in the course of their third rencontre that he was asking some odd, unconnected questions about her pleasure in being at Hunsford, which bones she had broken, and her opinion of the suitability of marriage for warriors such as they. She was engaged one day as she walked in perusing Jane's last letter and dwelling on some passages which proved that Jane had not written in spirits, when, instead of being again surprised by Mr. Darcy, she saw on looking up that Colonel Fitzwilliam was meeting her. Putting away the letter immediately and forcing a smile, she said, "I did not know before that you ever walked this way." "I have been making the tour of the park," he replied, "as I generally do every year, and intend to close it with a call at the parsonage. Are you going much farther?" "No, I should have turned in a moment." And accordingly she did turn, and they walked towards the parsonage together. At first their conversation consisted only of those usual pleasantries, observations on the weather, inquiries into the health of the other, and theories as to why God chose to curse England of all nations. This last subject, however, proved unhappily apt, for as the Colonel and Elizabeth reached a clearing on the path through the De Burgh forest, they perceived a single unmentionable in the distance, stumbling clumsily in tight circles. Elizabeth was momentarily alarmed, believing the creature to be poor Charlotte, no doubt escaped from the parsonage with bits of Mr. Collins' brains still clinging to her teeth. "If he had any brains at all," she thought. Upon a second inspection, however, she saw that it was a male, a boy of 16 or 17, and severely decomposed. His threadbare clothing suggested he had once been a coachman's apprentice. "I say," said the Colonel, "they become increasingly bold, do they not, wandering so near my aunt's?" "I believe the dreadful to be more confused than courageous, Colonel. As a rule, a lone zombie is a lost zombie. Shall I make haste to Rosings and fetch one of her ladyship's ninjas to fell the devil?" "You insult me, sir." "Miss Bennet, I am quite aware of your superior talent for cutting down the Lord's forsaken flock. I merely mean to spare your gown."
"Thank you," said Elizabeth, composing herself. "But I should rather my gown be soiled than my honour." Upon this she advanced upon the unmentionable. Never one to miss a display of Oriental wizardry, Colonel Fitzwilliam followed several steps behind her. He had expected Elizabeth to vanquish the creature straight away, perhaps taking its head with her ankle dagger, or delivering God's glorious justice with a flying kick to its middle. He was, therefore, surprised when she stopped short of the accursed wretch and produced a small stick from her ankle sheath. One of its tips was coated in a white substance of some kind. "My God, is that phosphorus?" said she. Colonel Fitzwilliam had heard of white phosphorus being used to burn the undead, but he had thought it too barbaric a practice for a trained warrior of the East, particularly one of Elizabeth's sex. Presently the unmentionable, who had been quite content walking in circles, took note of them and advanced with a roar.
Do you not think it an exceedingly cruel means of disposal, Miss Bennet?
You would rather I killed it nicely, Colonel?
I merely fail to see the necessity of torment, particularly when the odds are greatly in your favour. You know how fire frightens them so.
Is not the devil deserving of torment?
The devil, perhaps. But that boy...
Elizabeth's face went red. She lowered the stick, circled around the advancing zombie, and grabbed the back of its tattered jacket. Holding it thus, she pushed the creature forward until its rotted jaw was less than an arm's length from the colonel's face. He recoiled, holding his hands out to stop the advance, and nearly losing several fingers in the process. Overcome by the scent of fresh brains, the creature struggled mightily to free itself.